calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on the web, on AirAmericaRadio.com, WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, and CRN Digital, on cable TV systems, in fact, in 29 states. Cliff May is with us. He's with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, DefendDemocracy.org, his website. He's the president, in fact, of the foundation. Cliff, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
You have written an op-ed piece here. Scripps Howard News Service picked it up, about the Saudi government funding basically hatred of Jews and Christians. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Give us a snapshot of this.
Well, you've got it pretty much right. The Saudi government, and we've known this for a long time, actually, they put out various kinds of textbooks for school children, other kinds of information basically preaches hatred against Jews and Christians, what are called the infidels. Now, this was very well known prior to 9/11. After 9/11, actually, my organization, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, did a bit of a study on this and found that just terrible things were being said, the kinds of things that would make people want to go out and hijack an airplane and kill people. Let me call it up if you just give me one second.
Well, actually, I have the quotes right here. Yeah, I'll just share. Judaism and Christianity are deviant religions. Now, these are from textbooks that school children are using all around the world that are being paid for by the Saudi royal family.
Yeah.
Judaism and Christianity are deviant religions, quote, end quote, quote, the unbelievers, idolaters, and others like them must be hated and despised, end quote, quote, we say to every Christian and every Jew and all those outside Islam, your children are born into Islam, but you and their mother take them away from Islam with your corrupt rearing, end quote. These kinds of, quote, the apes are Jews, the people of the Sabbath.
Let me just point out, the ones you just said were the ones we found in the early study we did just after 9/11. Following that, a number of Saudi spokesmen said, hey, we're cleaning up our act. There's a lot of things in those books that shouldn't be there. They're from a different time, a different era. We're going to get rid of them. In fact, we're working very hard, and we have. What happened more recently was that Freedom House said, okay, let's go back and see what they're using right now. And so they looked at the books that were being used in 2005 in Saudi Arabia, being sent elsewhere to Germany.
Freedom House being the organization that Eleanor Roosevelt started.
A very good organization also here in town. They actually work with somebody we work with on the same project, a Saudi dissident in exile, Ali Ahmed, who managed to get hold of the books, and they had independent translators looking at them. And what they found is, despite the Saudis' protestations that they had gotten rid of all this stuff, they still found quotes like this, this one, the apes are Jews, the people of the Sabbath, while the swine are Christians, the infidels of the communion of Jesus, or the clash between the Muslim community and the Jews and Christians has endured and will endure as long as God wills. Whoever obeys the prophet and accepts the oneness of God cannot maintain a loyal friendship with those who oppose God and his prophet, even if they're his closest relatives. That means Jews and Christians again. Nina Shea, who was at Freedom House, pointed out that this stuff is indoctrinated into students beginning in about the first grade. By the 12th grade, they're being instructed that they have a religious obligation to wage jihad, a holy war, against the infidels in order to spread the faith.
Now, these are not religious schools that we're talking about.
They may be or they may not. That distinction doesn't necessarily exist in Muslim countries,
right.
And even in a place like Germany, if you're a Muslim student going to a private school, it's essentially a Muslim school. It's same in Virginia or any place else. So you can't necessarily tell. It's not just there, but it comes out of there.
Yeah. Now, two quick questions, Cliff May. The first may seem provocative. I'm really not trying to bait you with this. This is just a genuine question. How is this different than my friends who, when I was growing up, went to Catholic school, who told me that they were, now I'm not Catholic, I didn't go to Catholic school, I'm Protestant.
Yeah.
I dated a girl who was going to Catholic school, and she told me that she learned in her school that I was going to go to hell because I was not Catholic, and that she shouldn't marry me. I mean, how is that different?
Yeah, I think it's too bad, but if people want to believe that people of other religions don't go to heaven and go to hell instead, they're entitled to those beliefs. The difference is the kids you're talking about weren't told the infidels not only will go to hell, but it's your obligation to send them there. And you should pick up a weapon and do that, because that's your religious obligation.
Yeah, that is a substantial differentiation, although the Catholics were saying that in the 10th century. They're not saying that any longer.
Well, no, you're right. I mean, you can look back at the Inquisition or something like that, and look, any religion has some terrible periods and some periods of great intolerance. The problem is that we have a period of intolerance in regard to what we tend to call militant Islamism and Wahhabism, interpretations of Islam that are bellicose, that say the infidel must be not just competed with, but must be fought, must be subdued, must be conquered, must be killed.
Now,
that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I understand. I get it. And I share your concern. Here's my perhaps larger question. We're talking with Cliff May. He's the president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. DefendDemocracy.org is the website. Cliff, I've seen you, you know, many times on television talk shows and radio talk shows and whatnot, and read some of your writings and seen on your website positions that are strongly in defense of George W. Bush, the Bush administration, the war in Iraq, these kinds of situations. George W. Bush has been so intertwined over the years with the Saudi royal family and his father. I mean, the Bush family has, in various ways, through various business dealings and whatnot, basically taken about $1 billion over the last 35 years, not directly into the family, but into businesses associated with the family, from the Saudi royal family. How do you reconcile your support for the Bushes with your knowledge of what the Saudis are doing?
Well, most presidents, going back to Roosevelt, have had what's called a special relationship with the Saudis, and that may have been defensible during the Cold War.
Well, this goes way beyond that. I'm talking about a family relationship, not a presidential relationship.
I would hope that President Bush at this point recognizes the reality that.
Well, he was kissing a Saudi prince just 8 months ago, you know, and walking along holding hands with him. The brother of Osama bin Laden bailed him out when Arbusto, his oil company, went broke. His father was having breakfast with another brother of Osama bin Laden the morning of 9/11 as they were watching the planes hit the towers.
Part of my job is to make the reality of the Saudi Arabia understood by everybody, not least by people in this administration. I can't absolutely tell you that President Bush understands it, but I'm not sure he doesn't at this point. In terms, the problem is, what do we do about it? He may not know, and I'm not sure I know exactly. As awful as the current royal family is, it is possible to have worse. There is a reason why bin Laden is trying to kill members of the royal family from time to time. The reason is bin Laden thinks that the Saudi family doesn't have the courage of its convictions, that it's willing to go slow and take its time and doesn't want to fight the infidel right now and win right now. But I think the first thing is to recognize the reality of Saudi behavior and then begin to formulate policies that begin to push them in the right direction. Look, I'd love to see George Bush say publicly the Saudis need to show that they understand how things have changed, particularly since 9/11. They need to embrace the concept of tolerance, which has been foreign to Wahhabism in the past. I would like them to, as a beginning, invite priests and ministers and rabbis and people of other religion to come to Saudi Arabia as their guests for discussions. I'd like them to say there's nothing wrong with having a church on Saudi soil. We have many, many mosques in this country, many run by the Wahhabis, by the Saudis. I would like them to push in that direction.
Yeah, but they're not. I mean, the fact of the matter is they're not. You can't become a citizen of Saudi Arabia unless you're Muslim, period.
What's more, if you are a citizen of Saudi Arabia and you decide to convert to another religion.
Death sentence. Yeah. And every Friday in Riyadh, they have the public beheadings in the soccer stadium.
That's right.
We're talking with Cliff May, the president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, defenddemocracy.org. Cliff, we only have a minute and a half, 2 minutes here left. I'm curious, you have been an outspoken supporter of the war in Iraq, and yet it seems that if it was Wahhabists, bin Laden and his merry band, who attacked us in 9/11, and Saddam Hussein was a secularist who was absolutely opposed to pretty much everything that the Wahhabists stand for, that the war in Iraq has done absolutely everything that Osama bin Laden wanted rather than the other way around.
We don't have much time, so, but I would somewhat disagree with your characterization, but let me cut to the chase, which is this. We just killed Zarqawi, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. He was the commander of al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's a very good step. There is al-Qaeda in Iraq. Al-Qaeda is our enemy.
Bush had three opportunities to kill Zarqawi before we invaded Iraq, and in fact, we know now from documents that have been declassified that the third of those opportunities, a week before we attacked Iraq, he turned down because it would have eliminated his last rationale to invade Iraq. This was one guy running a training camp in the no-fly zone that was under our protection.
If you're talking about the Ansar al-Islam camp, I don't think you're correct that it was under our protection.
It was in the no-fly zone. Saddam wanted to get rid of these guys. He hated al-Qaeda. He could not go up there because they were under the no-fly zone.
I don't think that's correct, to be honest with you. I think the main point that I think we can agree on is wherever we find al-Qaeda, we must fight al-Qaeda. Right now we find al-Qaeda in Iraq. We should fight them there. We don't retreat from any battlefield where we find al-Qaeda.
Cliff May, the president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, defenddemocracy.org, the website. Cliff, thanks for coming
on
the program.
Thank you so much.
Good conversation. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it worse. Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first. Our highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed? Who has been cursed? There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
You tell him, Merle Haggard, 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful Thursday, the 15th of June. We were just talking with Cliff May, the very noble-sounding Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. But my sense of it is, and you know, you read into it, and of course everything Cliff talks about on TV is by and large, not everything, but by and large, Republican talking points or neocon talking points, I'd say. You know, the folks who let's fight al-Qaeda wherever we find them. They're in Iraq right now. We need to fight them there. Respectfully, they wouldn't be in Iraq if we weren't in Iraq. And Bush had three opportunities, three different chances he had to take out Zarqawi before we invaded Iraq. Before we attacked Iraq, and he didn't. He chose not to, and it's simple matter of fact. And not only that, he went to great lengths to expand the role of Zarqawi, to say that Zarqawi was much more of a big guy than he actually was, and that this is something that just frankly really concerns me that the Bush administration and the neocons in general are doing this. I do think it's important that we have these conversations with them and that, bring this stuff up, bring these issues up on a fairly regular basis. In particular, I suspect Mr. May is not used to having people contradict him. I mean, usually on TV shows, we're going to believe everything you say. Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about it. But no. Zarqawi, really, he's a symbol, frankly, of a mismanaged war. I mean, it just very, very simply. In fact, once the war was launched, George W. Bush was falsely claiming that the relationship between Zarqawi and Hussein, which didn't exist, was evidence that Saddam was working with al-Qaeda and thus a rationale for attacking Iraq. And in fact, if Saddam Hussein had had an opportunity to kill Zarqawi, he would have done it in a Baghdad minute, but he didn't have that opportunity because Zarqawi was up in the north, inside the no-fly zone, where we could have taken him out, and we chose not to. And it's just this concerns me, really concerns me. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. A lot in the news, a lot to talk about. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick, how's life there?
Beautiful weather here. How about you?
Just great. Just great. Thank you.
Well, I know you went to the Take Back America conference. Was that what it was called?
Yeah, I was there Monday and Tuesday, and then yesterday flew home, and I'm back in Portland.
Were you there when those folks booed Hillary?
I was. I wasn't in the room. I was on the air. But I could see it on the TV monitor, and one of the folks that I interviewed told us the story of it on the air Tuesday, and also I read the piece that I believe it was Medea Benjamin, the Code Pink people, wrote on commondreams.org.
So what did you think about it?
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton is trying to take this position of going down the middle on the war on Iraq. And my guess is that the political calculus behind this is that Bush is going to be able to pull a rabbit out of the hat, that Bush is going to be able to reclaim or regain support for the war. And he's going to do it by, number one, you know, this killing of Zarqawi is getting folks like Cliff May out there. I mean, they're getting all of their affiliated groups, all of their friendly groups, shall we say, into the media as much as they can, doing all the talk shows and doing all the talking head shows to say, oh yeah, well, you know, this proves that there's a Al Qaeda in Iraq, and don't forget Al Qaeda attacked us on 9/11, and we have now, of course, the memo, you know, coming down from John Bonner that we have to conflate 9/11 with Iraq whenever possible, and so I suspect that political calculus actually may have some accuracy to it, and by the time the 2008 election rolls around, number one, our troops in Iraq are going to have been pulled down to the point where it's probably not going to be a big issue, and number two, you know, because Bush is no idiot, maybe even by the election of 2006, wouldn't surprise me.
Well, I guess my point is, though, we know the right wing, for the most part, are bad guys. How far left are these people that think that Hillary deserves to be booed, though? You know what I mean?
Well, how far left? What do you mean?
Well, in other words, you were there. Were these just anti-war Democrats? I mean, they didn't have any Maoists or Trotskyists there, did they?
No, it was Code Pink. It was the women from Code Pink who were doing it, by and large.
Well, who are they? I mean,
Code Pink is basically an anti-war group. It's a group of women against the war. And I think CodePink.org is their website. You can check it out. But, you know, the bottom line, Rick, and the position that they take, and frankly, I do too, is that people are dying right now in Iraq. I mean, we just hit 2,500 dead soldiers, not to mention, you know, over 100,000 dead civilians. People are dying. And frankly, I think that anybody who supports this ongoing occupation of Iraq has some serious explaining to do, some serious responsibility for it. Rick, I got to run. Thanks for the call. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Civil rights leaders are a pain in the neck. Can't hold a candle to Chiang Kai-shek. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. And the bombers are afraid of a fight. Peace hurts business and that ain't right. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. 7 little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Greetings to the folks in the chat room. You drop by our live chat by going to tomhartman.com and click the live chat link. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. Well, the Supreme Court has gone. They are swinging so hard to the right. This is absolutely spooky. The Supreme Court ruled today that police armed with a warrant can barge into homes and seize evidence. This is from peoplepc.com. And seize evidence even if they don't knock. A huge government victory that was decided by President Bush's new justices. In other words, once they've got a warrant, they can just come bash in your door and come charging into your house, guns drawn, and you have, you know, no warning, no nothing. This is a 5-4 ruling. When this was argued originally, Sandra Day O'Connor was still on the court, and she said, is there no policy of protecting the homeowner a little bit and the sanctity of the home from this immediate entry? Stephen Breyer wrote, this weakens, perhaps destroys, much of the practical value of the Constitution's knock-and-announce protection. Breyer said the police will feel free to enter homes without knocking and waiting a short time if they know that they are there with a warrant to do so. So it's no longer in America is it knock, knock, we're here to execute a warrant, let us in. Now it is, boom, the door falls in and you've got cops all over the house. And keep in mind, under the new Patriot Act, anything that interferes with commerce is considered terrorism. So they could barge into your house for terrorism, for anything that you did to interfere with commerce, which covers some pretty broad territory. It could even be, for example, protesting against fur outside of a shop that sells fur, or it could be protesting against McDonald's out in front of McDonald's. I mean, you fill in the blank, right? I guess we're all terrorists now. It's anybody who has an opinion about anything that might be of some harm to some business. Somebody speaking out against credit card companies, for example. Right now, the credit card companies are pushing legislation that would make it illegal nationwide for you to call your credit, one of the credit agencies, and put a freeze on your credit. I mean, this is mind-boggling. You've got right now, the situation is there's a bunch of states where you can put a freeze on your credit reporting, and you can simply say, that's it. You know, do not give my credit information out to anybody, which means, in effect, that you can't get any credit, or that nobody else could get credit in your name. So, you know, and if you know that over the next 6 months you're not going to be applying for a credit card, you know that you're not going to be applying for a car loan or a home loan, but you're concerned that maybe your identity has been stolen. Let's say you're one of those 44 million American veterans. You call one of the credit bureaus, and you say, put a freeze on my credit. It doesn't mean that you can't use your existing credit cards. It means that you and nobody using your name and Social Security number can apply for credit until you say, take the freeze off. Now, why would the credit card companies be trying to make this illegal? By the way, the states that right now permit all consumers to freeze credit, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maine, Minnesota, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Oklahoma, North Carolina, Utah, Vermont, and Wisconsin. And if you are the victim of identity theft, in addition, you can freeze your credit in Hawaii, Kansas, South Dakota, Texas, and Washington. So there's good reasons why you may want to choose to do this. Or say your wallet gets stolen or lost. You just want to freeze your credit for a couple of months. Again, it doesn't mean you can't use your credit cards. It means that nobody can apply for new credit using your name. So why would the credit card companies say that they want that to be against the law? Because they want to sell you credit protection. You get it? They see this as a business opportunity. 44 million American veterans now, terrified that their information is out there in the public. Not to mention, I mean, millions of other Americans. A couple hundred thousand records stolen from this bank, a million records stolen from that credit card company. You know, all the time we hear stories about records that could be used for identity theft being stolen. Well, all the credit card companies now are offering these deals where, hey, give us $50 a month, give us $60 a month, and we'll protect your credit forever. And we'll let you know if anybody tries to use your credit. You know, Credit Shield, Credit Guard, they've got all these names. It's a new product they can sell you. Well, you don't need that product if you freeze your credit. So they want to make it against the law for you to freeze your credit so that you will have to buy their product. This is the story. This is in USA Today. The day before yesterday, Brian Achito wrote it. He says, Congress is considering preempting laws in 17 states. In other words, they're going to overturn states' laws. The Republicans, the big government Republicans, overturn state laws. Congress is considering preempting laws in 17 states that allow anyone to freeze their own credit and instead restricting the privilege to ID theft victims. And that's after the fact, by the way, after you've already been damaged by the theft. The proposed Financial Data Protection Act of 2006 sounds nice, doesn't it? expected to be voted on by the House as soon as next week, comes on the heels of the recent theft of sensitive data of 26 million veterans and active-duty military personnel. I said 44, I guess it's 26. If it becomes law, vets and military personnel who live in states that permit unrestricted credit freezes would lose that option. A credit freeze cuts off access to your credit history, since most banks and merchants insist on seeing a credit report before issuing credit. Identity thieves can't open bogus accounts using ill-gotten data. Under the bill, backed by the financial services industry, simply having your data lost or stolen isn't enough. You must file a police report describing a specific instance of it being used to commit a crime. In other words, you can't get your credit frozen until after you've already been ripped off. As Washington State Attorney General Rob McKenna said, it's like telling someone you can't put a deadbolt on your front door until after you've been burglarized. The bill, according to the USA Today story, the bill would also preempt laws in 29 states requiring companies, institutions, and agencies to notify individuals about security breaches compromising their data. In other words, they don't have to tell you anymore. Again, they're going to force you to pay for it. I mean, just how sick and twisted is this? And yet I'm telling you, the Republicans, in all probability, are going to push this through. It's amazing. No knock warrant. This, and then, of course, as I said before, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, Jim Michaleshewski of NBC News reported this 2 years ago. 2 years ago. NBC News has learned that long before the war, as long before the invasion of Iraq, the Bush administration had several chances to wipe out Zarqawi's operation and perhaps kill Zarqawi himself, but never pulled the trigger. And they go through the three times that they did it, that they could have done it. And then they add, in January 2003, the threat turned real, blah, blah, blah. The Pentagon drew up still another attack plan, and for the third time, the National Security Council, that's Condoleezza Rice, killed it. Military officials insist their case for attacking Zarqawi's operation was airtight. I'm quoting from Jim Michaleshewski of NBC News. But the administration feared destroying the terrorist camp in Iraq could undercut its case for war against Saddam. You get how craven and manipulating this whole thing is? Amazing. Tim in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Well, hey, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court decision to strike down the knock on the door when you're served with a search warrant. This totally now eliminates what used to be referred to as the old Texas search warrant, where two police go to your door. One goes to the front door, the other goes to the back door. The guy knocks on the front door while the guy at the back door yells, "Come in." They don't even have to do that anymore.
Yeah, there you go.
Tom, thanks.
Thank you very much, Tim. And again, it's, you know, people say, well, you know, if you're innocent, you have nothing to fear. Well, that's the whole point. The whole point of the protection of the people from the power of government. Keep in mind, government is the only authority that has the legal right to charge into your home with guns and kill you, for that matter, if they perceive a threat. The whole point of the protection against the power of government is because not everybody is guilty. A lot of people get arrested and get off, and it's not because they got a good lawyer. It's because they weren't guilty in the first place. Number one. And number two, there's a good reason to knock on the door and announce yourself as the police, because a lot of people in the United States have guns or knives or weapons or baseball bats, and if they hear somebody kick in their door, they may just grab that gun from beside the bed and start shooting. And then the cops come in with their automatic weapons and they kill you dead. I would think the NRA right now would be going nuts on this thing, because the gun owners of America are the people who are most likely going to be shot dead by the police. Steve in Nebraska. Hey, Steve, we have 30 seconds before we have to take a break. Quick point.
Okay, quick point. I'm saying let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. No-knock warrants make sense sometimes, but doesn't the warrant have to say no-knock?
Yeah, there are times when you actually could get no-knock warrants before. If you thought that the person was armed, if you thought that there was a probability that announcing yourself would put you in, but you had to prove it to the judge.
So I'm just saying, I don't have a problem with it if it's on the warrant because of crack houses and real terrorists.
No, I'm with you. I mean, there are times when a no-knock warrant is appropriate, but I'd like a judge to filter that before some guy comes kicking in my door, or yours, or anybody else's. Thanks a lot, Steve.
We agree. I'll
talk to you later. Bye. Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate it. Amazing. What this right-wing Supreme Court. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There you go. Net neutrality. Let us save the Internet. I can't believe the right-wingers are out there running this campaign saying, don't let the government control the Internet. You don't want the government controlling the Internet. Amazing. Amazing. It's just wrong. Welcome back to our program. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX. Is the telephone number, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com. Of course, their website, you can get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh. So bless you for buying iPods from Small Dogs, Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX. And, of course, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE. Welcome back to the program. Brent in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Brent, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thank you for your program. You introduced me to a thought some time back about how the dot-coms prosecutions never went forth, the frauds that occurred on Wall Street, and I wanted to thank you for that. You mentioned earlier today that what the Republicans are pulling out is this equating the war in Iraq with 9/11.
Right.
And... you know,
I should say successfully, by the way. Bush has already seen his approval ratings go up 8 or 9 points now in the last week as a result of this, and thus he hightailed it over to Iraq. Can you imagine if Vladimir Putin just showed up in Washington, D.C. one day and said, "Hi, I'm here. I want to see the president."
But what I hope that Democrats, and particularly you, putting a little pressure on you, is that every time that they bring this up, we need to, one, let them know that they didn't get Osama bin Laden, and they didn't get the anthrax terrorist.
Yeah.
And the anthrax terrorist is the one who really gave us the war in Iraq. The 9/11...
Well, certainly gave us
the
Patriot Act.
...terrorist equaled, and because they handed it to us,
yeah.
Osama bin Laden. And yet, we never hear the administration ever talk about that. And it's critical to the war.
Well, it makes you wonder why that is, you know, because the anthrax, the timing on that and the people involved was just so weird. Jim Jeffords, the senator, the Republican senator from Vermont, the only Republican that I've voted for in the last 30 years, Jim Jeffords was in the United States Senate, and he got so fed up with the way that the Bush was doing things that he said, okay, that's it, I'm leaving the party. And, I mean, you know, he'd already left the party long before in terms of policy, but he said, that's it, I'm leaving the party. And that flipped the control of the Senate to the Democrats. This was in 2001, right? And as a result of that, the guy who became able to decide whether legislation would come to the floor and get a vote was Tom Daschle. And the head of the Judiciary Committee became Patrick Leahy, the other senator from Vermont.
And he also got anthraxed.
That's where I'm going with this. So the Patriot Act comes before Congress. Jim Jeffords flips. Now it's Daschle and Leahy, the only two people, literally the only two people who could have stopped the Patriot Act. It could have been stopped in committee, in the Judiciary Committee, or it could have been stopped once it got to the floor if Daschle refused to schedule a vote on it. These are the only two people in the Senate who could have stopped the Patriot Act, and they are the only two people in all of Congress, out of the 535 members of Congress, who got anthrax in the mail. Who had to leave their offices, who had to leave behind all the paperwork they had, who had been openly voicing objections and concerns about the Patriot Act, who had to do business out of a suitcase someplace without their information, without their data, and ultimately said okay, and essentially, you know, and Daschle scheduled the vote, and boom, the thing passed. And now we still don't know who this anthrax, who sent the anthrax. All we know is that it is a military-grade anthrax that came from one of the U.S. military weapons laboratories. And, you know, I I'm not wearing a tinfoil hat on this. Everything I'm telling you was right there in the New York Times. And there hasn't been word one out of this administration about that.
Can I put it in a nutshell here? if the anthrax terrorist was a government official, which you would have had to have been to have access to it, and you would have been a very limited group of people. We know that the Bush administration wanted to go to war in Iraq even before they were in power, but at their first cabinet meeting, their first topic, their first agenda was Iran, was Iraq.
Yeah, as O'Neill pointed out in his book.
After 9/11, we were all Americans. We weren't Republicans, we weren't Democrats. And yet, who did the anthrax terrorist attack? The media and the Democrats. Both are the arch enemies of Republicans.
Of the right.
And of the right. And if you look at it, it means that somebody at the very top, I mean, if they had the motive to go to war, and they had the access to such a thing, somebody at the very, very top would have had to have known about that. Now, who could that possibly have been? I put forth Ice Scooter Libby. What was his background? His forte was biological weapons. He would have known whom in that limited circle of people.
What was Libby's association with biological weapons?
That was his forte.
His area of expertise?
Aid. That was his area of expertise. And if he was such an expert, I mean, what a strange position. And he was
The fact of the matter is, you know, until we get Democrats in control of the House and Senate, we'll never find out, because the Republicans have refused to schedule even one inquiry, even into the anthrax killings. They have refused to schedule even one congressional inquiry into the anthrax killings. I mean,
they call him Cheney's Cheney. What does that mean? Yeah. Right of Attila the Hun?
Yeah, there you go. Brent, thanks a lot for the call. It's absolutely incredible. After the break, economics on the home front. In the third hour, by the way, Brad Friedman's going to be joining us for the latest on the Busby campaign, electronic voting machines, and the theft of elections in general. We'll be back with your calls and more after the news at the top of the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not from some right-wing think tank or the RNC. Truth in broadcasting. For a change! We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes before or after the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, so much amazing stuff in the news. The Republicans now are going to be debating Iraq. I have been saying this for forever. The Republicans are going to make this an issue, and they are going to win with it. The Democrats are looking at absolute electoral disaster in November if they don't get their act together and their message together, particularly around Iraq. Bush's strategy, the Republican strategy, it's not just Bush's, it's really the Karl Rove strategy. The Republican strategy on Iraq, politically, the political strategy, is, you know, we know that their military strategy is a total botch up. But the political strategy is twofold. Number one, to portray what's going on in Iraq as a war, that we are fighting a war against somebody. Now, if you're fighting a war, you must be fighting against somebody. The reality, for those of us who live in the reality-based world and are moderately well-informed, you know, pay attention to the news, the reality is that 95%, more or less, you know, plus or minus 1 or 2% of the attacks against Americans in Iraq are coming from Iraqis. That's called an insurgency, not a war. It's a very different thing. What it means is that we are not engaged in a war. We're engaged in an occupation. We are occupying Iraq, and the occupied country, the people in that occupied country are saying, you know, we'd really rather you weren't here. But the Bushies, are going to try and convince Americans that we are in a war. Now, in order to have a war, you have to have an enemy. And I pointed out before how Zarqawi was basically a nobody. He was a nobody who wanted to become a somebody, and Bush made him a somebody because it benefited Bush. Well, once Bush kills Zarqawi, he's got to come up with somebody else. I guarantee you. I guarantee you there will be a new leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and his name will be a household word within a month, probably within a week, but certainly by November of 2006, there will be a new leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And even though it's not al-Qaeda who is attacking us the vast majority of the time in Iraq, there will be... All the press reports are going to be about this. The White House is going to be, Tony Snow's going to be talking about it. The president's going to be talking about it. Everything is going to be about the new leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. We got the old leader, now we got a new leader. So, number one, the Republicans are going to continue to use this meme of it's a war. And number two, they're going to continue to try and convince Americans that the enemy that we are fighting the war against is al-Qaeda. Now, if it's al-Qaeda, then, hey, you know, there's a pretty good consensus across the United States. It was al-Qaeda who attacked us on 9/11 and the USS Cole and the earlier World Trade Center bombing and. And so, gee, if we're fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq, it must be that we went into Iraq to punish those SOBs who knocked down the towers, right? Who attacked the Pentagon. Who hijacked that airplane that those people so nobly took control of, as we saw in that movie about Flight 93. The Bush administration is reinventing the war. And until the Democrats figure this out, it just amazes me. I mean, I had this conversation with Harry Reid last week. I had four different members of Congress I talked to, earlier this week, Monday and Tuesday of this week at the Take Back America conference. Four different members of Congress, and again this morning I had this conversation with Earl Blumenauer, and said, until you guys stop using the word war, and take that away from George W. Bush, you're going to lose. Because nobody wants to lose a war. Everybody wants to win a war. Even if it's the wrong war, people want to win the war. Well, we're already in the war, so we've got to win it. That's kind of the Hillary position, right? That's the Joe Lieberman position. We're in a war, we got to win it. But if it's not a war, if it's an occupation, well, you know, it's an occupation, it's time to end the occupation. You know, we occupied Germany for a little while. Well, there's still troops in Germany. Yes, but they're not occupying troops. Germany's running itself, thank you very much. Our troops in Germany are allies who are there, or who were there, to protect Germany from the Soviet Union. Not to occupy Germany. The occupation of Germany didn't last even a year. Germany started rebuilding itself. And by the way, that occupation of Germany that we had after World War II was by and large a feeding operation. Because people were starving. We had destroyed so much of their infrastructure. They were having cholera epidemics. They were having famine. And you read Theodore White's book about... I forget the title, but you can find Theodore White. About his writings, he was in Germany at the end of World War II. Just traveled around the country. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling. So if we can reframe this thing as an occupation, if we can cause people to think of it as an occupation, if the Democrats stop using the word war... And for that matter, we have to stop using the word war. We, you know, in time of war, no, it's not time of war. It's a time of occupation. Well, what about al-Qaeda? They're after us. Yes, and they're criminals. It's not a war. Was Britain having a war with the Irish Republican Army? No. They were trying to round up criminals. Is Spain having a war with ETA? With the Basque separatists? No, it's not a war. It's an insurgency, you could argue. It's a nationalist movement. But you know, was Italy having a war with the with the Red Brigades. I mean, they, after all, they kidnapped a prime minister, put him in the trunk of a car. He died. Was it a war? No. They arrested these people as criminals, held them criminally responsible, put them in prison, and that was the end of it. If we want to succeed in ending radical Islam's attempts to bring down Western society, or at least America, the American part of Western society, if we want to succeed in doing that, we have to take a lesson from, oddly enough, Hamas. I mean, you know, what have these folks, or Al-Qaeda for that matter, what have they done? They go in and they feed people. They run schools. They run hospitals. And the people go, oh, these are pretty good guys. We used to do this. This used to be the foreign policy of the United States. We were the good guys, remember? We're here with care. We're here with, it's, you know, food from the United States. We're airlifting supplies into famine areas. We're bringing in doctors into hospitals. We've got the Peace Corps going, helping hold the peace together all around the world. Now, if American groups show up in half the world, or not half the, in many countries in the world, it's like you've got a bullseye on your back because of the Bush foreign policy. We need to clearly identify what is going on in Iraq as an occupation. And once the American people get it, and once the Democrats are successful in that meme, in putting forward that meme, this is the occupation of Iraq. And the occupation of Iraq today, get the news reporters to talk about it. It's not a war in Iraq. It is an occupation. There's not a war on terror any more than there's a war on drugs or a war on poverty. It's a rhetorical device. There are criminals out there who operate outside the mainstream of their own religion. They operate outside the mainstream of any country. They are criminals. We need to have a worldwide police action against them. Get the police of the nations of the world together. Get Interpol together and treat them like, you know, they're terrorists. Let's go after them. It's the mafia for all practical purposes. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now there are rumors in the camp about our enemy. They say that when you see him, he looks just like you and me. But you deny it, Sergeant, and you are a man of war. So you must give me lessons, for I've never killed before.
And welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Telling the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Victoria Jones is on the line with us, our senior Tony Snow correspondent from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria Jones.
Well, hey, Tom.
So you talked to Tony today.
I did talk to Tony today, yes. We just had a press briefing, and I had a couple of things about Karl Rove I wanted to ask him, because only one journalist before me asked a question about Karl Rove, and a lot of people asked questions. There were about 12 people who went before me to ask questions, and nobody mm-hmm. seemed to care.
Mm-hmm. So you said?
Well, the first question was that the president yesterday said that he's made the comments he's going to make about the Karl Rove matter, and he's going to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Yet he told us a year ago, at least twice, that he'd be happy to make comments about this once the investigation's complete. So does this mean that despite telling us that he'd be happy to make comments, he now will not? Or does this mean that at a later date he is going to make comments?
Or does it mean the investigation's not complete?
Exactly.
Yeah. And what did he say?
Well, I got a lot of humming and hawing and huffing and puffing, and that he stands by his comments, which I thought was an odd statement. And then eventually I got that I really don't know what the president is going to do. And I wanted to say, well, then, why didn't you tell me that in the first place?
Yeah.
Because that's, frankly, a very reasonable answer.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Did anybody bring up with him his comments about Jimmy Carter this morning on Don Imus' show?
No, nobody did.
You're familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yes, about Jimmy Carter going on vacation.
Sneaking off to go fishing.
Yes.
Yeah, and George W. Bush holds the world's record for sneaking off to go fishing. And in fact, George W. Bush has his own man-made pond stocked with fish that he can catch. And or whatever you call it, when you're catching things out of a man-made pond. And then he also made a joke about how Carter couldn't deal with the kidnapping, and yet there have been more kidnappings in Iraq than there ever were in Iran. So I don't know.
Nobody. I think. Look, I think most people don't read that website. I do.
Yeah. Are you talking about Think Progress?
Yes.
ThinkProgress.org.
I was more focused on Rove. My other Rove question, by the way, happened to be because the question did come up about, look, he's not being indicted, but there's a question of what standard there has to be to work at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony Snow was sort of going on a little bit about honorable, and so I raised the question again about it being an honorable standard. And I said, look, 3 years ago he was asked, in this room, whether in fact he'd spoken to any reporter about Valerie Plame working for the CIA. And Tony Snow stopped me and you know, basically said that he wasn't here then and he didn't want to be dragged into this. And he wasn't going to talk about this. And so I said, well, can I at least finish my question? Well, you can finish it, but I'm not going to answer. You know, this will be up on our website later today.
The audio?
Yeah. So I'm going on about, well, I'd like to finish my question, please. Oh, go ahead. So feeling a bit of a fool, because I'm now going to recite a question that I have to make up as I go along, that is not going to be answered, I ask my question.
Mm-hmm.
To which, you know, he basically lets me ask, looks at me, and moves on. It was quite surreal.
Amazing.
But it's on the record, because the point is that it was a question I asked 3 years ago, but I wasn't going to say that. But he was asked whether he talked to any reporter about Valerie Plame working for the CIA.
Carl Rove was asked.
Well, Scott McClellan was asked whether Carl Rove had done that.
Right.
And Scott McClellan said that Carl Rove had assured him he was not involved in any of this. Mm-hmm. And I then pointed out to Tony Snow he talked to Matt Cooper, Judith Miller, and Robert Novak. Mm-hmm. I said, the answers don't mesh. And then he said, I'm not getting mixed up in this, and he moved on to the next person.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's a tough job being the spokesperson for basically an organized crime syndicate, which is what the Republican Party and the Bush administration have morphed into. It's got to be a really tough job. By the way, Victoria Jones, for the future, I just want to let our listeners know, in this segment of the show, about, you know, more or less about 20 minutes after the second hour of the program, 5 days a week, you or somebody else from Talk Radio News calls in, and we talk for 10 minutes or so. And if any of our listeners have questions for a real White House correspondent with complete with credentials who can show up at the White House, they're welcome to call in. You're all welcome to call in, because you will take calls.
We'll take calls. May not know the answer.
Yeah.
But we'll straightforwardly say, I haven't a clue.
Yeah. Or you may know. You may know the answer. So I've been predicting that Bush, in order to have the persona of Superman, he has to have a Lex Luthor. You know, Batman has to have a Joker, right?
Absolutely.
Or a Penguin or whatever.
Absolutely.
And yeah. And so Bush had to have, and Bin Laden was Bush's Lex Luthor for a while, but he couldn't catch him, and so he had to get rid of him as a Lex Luthor as quickly as he could, and essentially stop thinking about him. You know.
So I don't know where he is. I just don't spend that much time on him. I'll be honest with you.
Again. So you know, he had to do that, and so he had to invent a new Lex Luthor that he could actually find and kill, and that became Zarqawi. Well, now he's killed Zarqawi, and if Bush wants to continue to be Superman, he's going to have another Lex Luthor.
Yes, he is.
So who's the next Lex Luthor?
Well, it could be Al Zawahiri, but he's going to be difficult to find. Maybe it's going to be this Al Masri, who's the one who they think is the successor to Al Zarqawi. Or maybe what they're going to do is that now that they've got Al Zarqawi, they're now moving on to this sort of almost victory march.
Yeah, right. Yeah, as we just had our 2,500
dead. But you see, you know, we've got elections in a few months. Carl Rove is off the hook. He can concentrate. They've got that resolution in the House today that's going to make the Democrats look stupid. You've got John Kerry and Hillary Clinton saying directly opposite things about when we should get out of the war. You've got Dems in disarray.
Mm-hmm. It's not good.
It's not good for them.
It's just not good. I mean, the Republicans are playing this thing like a political, like a Stradivarius.
Yes.
Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website. Victoria, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
There was the passion you needed the most. Oh, you and I. You kick up the leaves and the magic is lost. 'Cause you had a bad day. You take your one down. You sing a sad song just to turn it around. You take it down low.
Oh, and we thought Bush was having a bad day, but I'm telling you, the months, as Karl Rove knows, you can let things go bad when it's not an election month. The months that count are the 2 months before the election, because those 2 months, the average American, the vast majority of Americans, are not listening to political talk radio. They're not reading the newspaper carefully. They're not paying much attention to the news. They are paying attention to things like sports or, you know, They're just conducting their lives. They're taking their kids to the soccer game. You know, a bit of a cliche, I suppose, but whatever. They're working two or three jobs. I mean, they're just getting by, and they're not paying that much attention to politics. Most Americans, frankly, don't until a couple of months before an election. And Bush knows. Hey, you know, he's like, you know, his poll ratings are 31%, and You get David Gregory from NBC News sitting there. We're doing that interview with George W. down in, what was it, down in Texas, I believe it was. And he says, Mr. President, you know, the majority of Americans think you suck, or words to that effect. And Bush goes, yeah, I don't care, or words to that effect. And you say, you know, well, why? Why would he say, well, I don't care? Because he understands that it doesn't matter what his poll numbers are until October and November of 2004. And 2006 and 2008. Those are the months. Those are the times. That's when everybody has to pay attention. And so what they're doing right now is they're jockeying everything into position. They're setting up the. I'm telling you, these guys are playing chess, not checkers. They're looking seven moves ahead, not two. And they are putting all the pieces into place. Economically, they're doing this to continue the destruction of the American middle class. With regard to voting, they're doing this to continue the disenfranchisement of poor Americans, of Americans of color. I had a fellow on the program on Tuesday who said over 70% of African Americans in Wisconsin. Now, Wisconsin, there's not a lot of African Americans in Wisconsin. And perhaps that's why he was using that state as an example. But over 70% of African-American males in Wisconsin don't have a driver's license. They live in an urban environment. They don't drive. They don't need to drive. Or they're poor. They can't afford a car. And so what's the Republican response to this? Let's require a driver's license to vote. A lot of elderly people don't have driver's licenses. Well, you know, they tend to vote Democratic. Let's have a requirement that you have to have a driver's license to vote. Or even better than that, let's go with a national ID card. Are you worried about illegal immigration? Well, hey, this is a job for Halliburton. Let's build a wall. And let's find some other contractor to come up with some ID cards. It's nuts. And now, to make things even stranger, the states are starting to sell off their roads. They're selling off their roads. But before I even get to that, this from the right wing, from Jerome Corsi, right, the Swift Boat guy, and Human Events Online. You know, sometimes right-wingers are concerned about the same thing left-wingers are concerned about. I mean, it's sometimes there's just, like, things that it's useful to be concerned about. He's writing in Human Events, another right-wing publication. He says, quietly but systematically, the Bush administration is advancing the plan to build a huge NAFTA superhighway, 4 football fields wide, through the heart of the U.S. along Interstate 35 from the Mexican border at Laredo, Texas, to the Canadian border north of Duluth, Minnesota. Now, why would this be news or perhaps even good news to conservatives? Well, here it is in the second paragraph. Once complete, the new road will allow containers from the Far East. Now, this is, you know, these giant, this basically, you know, the back end of a 16-wheeler. These containers, they come in, you know, hundreds of them, thousands of them, perhaps. I don't know, many hundreds, certainly, on ships from China, bringing all kinds of cheap junk in from China for Walmart and others. Okay, so the containers. Once complete, the new road will allow containers from the Far East to enter the United States through the Mexican port of Lázaro Cárdenas, bypassing the Longshoremen's Union in the process. They will, so no union guys offshoring, offloading this stuff. No American companies running the ports. And then they put it on a Mexican truck. And you'll recall last year, George W. Bush changed the rules to say that Mexican truckers can operate in the United States. So they put them on Mexican trucks, and they're non-union truck drivers. And they're driving, you know, Mexican-owned trucks. And they drive into the United States. And, well, and so out go the Teamsters as well. They, in fact, back to Corsi's article here, the Mexican trucks, without the involvement of the Teamsters Union... Can't you just see it? The right wingers just, you know, rubbing their hands going, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. The Mexican trucks, without the involvement of the Teamsters Union, will drive on what will be the nation's most modern highway straight into the heart of America. The Mexican trucks will cross the border in FAST lanes, all caps, fast lanes, checked only electronically by the new, quote, Sentry, S-E-N-T-R-I system. This is an acronym. The first customs stop. Now get this, they're coming into Mexico on the Pacific side of Mexico. They cross Mexico and they go in through through Texas and drive up into the United States without the cargo being checked. Without the cargo being checked. The first customs stop will be a Mexican customs office in Kansas City. Their new smart port complex, a facility being built for Mexico at the cost of $3 million to the U.S. taxpayers in Kansas City. Corsi writes, as incredible as this plan may seem to some readers, the first Trans-Texas Corridor segment of the NAFTA Superhighway, it's called the NAFTA Superhighway, right, is ready to begin construction next year. Various U.S. government agencies, dozens of state agencies, and scores of private NGOs, non-governmental organizations, have been working behind the scenes to create the NAFTA superhighway, despite the lack of comment on the plan by President Bush. The American public is largely asleep to this key piece of the coming North American Union. The government planners in the new trilateral region of the United States, Canada, and Mexico are about to drive into reality. About to drive it into reality. This is the result of a March 23rd, 2005 meeting in Waco, Texas. Remember, this is a year and a couple months ago when Vicente Fox, George Bush, and Paul Martin, who was then the Prime Minister of Canada, met in Waco, Texas, and they signed this SPP agreement, Security and Prosperity Partnership. According to the Department of Commerce website, a U.S.-Mexico Joint Working Committee on Transportation Planning has finalized a plan such that, quote, methods of detecting bottlenecks on the U.S.-Mexico border will be developed and low-cost, high-impact projects identified in bottleneck studies will be constructed or implemented, end quote. The report notes, this from Corsi's piece, the report notes that new Sentry travel lanes in the Mexican border will be constructed this year. The border at Laredo should be reduced to an electronic speed bump for the Mexican trucks containing goods from the Far East to enter the U.S. on their way to the Kansas City smart port. Is your mind boggled yet? Supreme Court says the cops can kick in your door. Bush, you know, without knocking. Bush says Mexican truckers can enter the United States without knocking. In the meantime, Dateline Elkhart, Indiana, Amy Goldstein writing in the Washington Post, Indiana, the official state motto, the crossroads of America. Indiana is about to turn over its entire toll road for the next 75 years to two foreign countries, making it more expensive to drive. The decision to hand the Indiana toll road to an Australian and Spanish team for $3.8 billion at the end of this month has blown up into one of the biggest brawls in Indiana in a generation. The decision also places Indiana at the leading edge of a nascent trend in which states and local governments are exploring the idea of privatizing parts of the United States' prized interstate highway system. Dwight Eisenhower has got to be rolling over in his grave. She said, Amy Goldstein writes, the idea goes beyond projects such as the North Virginia's Dulles Greenway, in which states have turned to private companies to build or widen toll roads. Now they're considering selling or leasing some of the best-known and most-traveled routes across America. The trend started a year and a half ago when Chicago Mayor Richard Daley pushed through a 99-year lease of the Chicago Skyway. $1.8 billion he got from this thing. Now, why would a for-profit company buy the Chicago Skyway? Because they can make money on it! Why should a private corporation be making money on our roads? Why shouldn't we, if money is to be made? Or why not say, hey, it's part of the commons. We're going to operate it at break-even, since it's ours. Well, it's not ours anymore because we're selling it. Since then, a New Jersey, Amy Goldstein writes in the Washington Post, since then, a New Jersey lawmaker has proposed selling a 49% interest in the New Jersey Turnpike and the Garden State Parkway. George Pataki, the governor of New York, is trying to persuade the legislature, good Republican, to let investors rebuild or replace the Hudson River Zapentee Bridge. In Houston, Harris County officials are studying leasing 75 miles of toll roads. And on it goes. The privatization of America. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG in Grand Rapids. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, Thomas, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
Hey, just want to make a recommendation. Maybe you can announce this from time to time just as a way of getting around all the roadblocks and impediments to people voting this year. Mm-hmm. Just recommending that in the states and the cities where Republicans control things, networking and getting together and getting people who aren't able to get to the Secretary of State on their own to get licenses or state IDs. Because we know that Republicans, right-wingers, don't want to the vote to increase.
That's right.
It pushes their numbers down.
Yep.
So as many people as possible that can network and get together with people who aren't able to do this, get them to the Secretary of State so that they can not only register, which is a more reliable way of registering, but getting Michigan ID or getting IDs and driver's license.
Right. Yeah. And Michigan, most states offer an ID that is not a driver's license ID for people who don't want to go through the whole driver's exam and everything. They just want, here's who I am kind of ID.
Right. And also, Hillary would be a bad choice for president. She would be a sure loser. So I just wanted to throw that out there, too, for anybody who's imagining that she might be a salvation for the Democratic Party. She would not be. Nobody's going to vote for a woman, especially a liberal Democrat woman.
Well, I'm not sure that nobody's going to vote for a woman. I mean, you know, Margaret Thatcher was elected in the UK. Golda Meir was one of the first presidents of Israel. There have been we just had a woman elected in Argentina, and that's, or was it Chile? No, it was Argentina, I think. And that's an incredibly, I mean, the Latin countries, you talk about, you know, rampant sexism, far worse than the United States.
Well, like you, I would support her, but given the temperament of the media, they would make sure that there was enough venom to last for several Clinton generations to be heaped on her.
Yeah, for sure. She's going to have a tough road to hoe if she is the nominee. But there's a lot of time. Yeah, a lot of time between now and then. It's interesting.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Jason, for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. There's a poll over at Democrats.com asking, you know, who do you think should be the presidential nominee? And Al Gore got 38% of the vote. Russ Feingold got 20% of the vote. Hillary got 18% of the vote. John Edwards and Wes Clark both got 8% of the vote. Joe Biden and Evan Bayh both got 3% of the vote. John Kerry got 5% of the vote. Mark Warner got 5% of the vote. So it looks to me like Al Gore and Russ Feingold, who are probably my two favorite candidates. I'm surprised, by the way, that Barbara Boxer isn't on this list. I think that she's also a strong potential candidate. But Al Gore and Russ Feingold, right up at the top. I'm surprised John Edwards, frankly, didn't do better with only 8% of the vote. I thought he was really good. Rebecca in Edmond, Washington. Hey, Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Well, I guess the key word I'd like to talk about is ignorance in the sense of not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
I have to hope that Harry Reid is ignorant about framing, because otherwise he's intentionally doing it. But
are you talking about my conversation with him on Monday?
Well, no, but you know, you were talking about the people in the shadows frame. You were talking with Jeffrey Feldman last week.
Right.
Okay, Harry Reid, at that conference, I didn't watch the conference very much, or the convention, the yearly COAST, is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about the Take Back America conference. That's where I was on Monday and Tuesday.
I wasn't able to follow that, but
yeah.
I have watched parts of it on C-SPAN. But Harry Reid said at one of these conferences, he talked about we have to bring these people in from the shadows, or in out of the shadows, talking about the immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times he falls right into the Republican frames.
Sure.
He does, and so do some leading, not you, but other talk show hosts. And I think there's just so much to know that a lot of us are ignorant about many issues, and so we learn a lot through your program. But I think what we need to do is we need to organize when we become aware of these bad frames, the frames that are working against us, and we all need to contact people like Senator Reid and say, do you know this? Please don't say this, because.
Yeah.
And we need
yeah.
to get organized. We need hundreds of people contacting him and asking him. I think somehow they need a workshop for people at the top of the party.
No, I agree. And actually, you know, the Democrats have brought in George Lakoff from time to time. But it's more, I don't know. It doesn't seem to be working.
Well,
what do you think about my suggestion that Democrats should stop using the word war and start using the word occupation?
Oh, that one, I love that idea. In fact, I've been listening all morning, and I just think that's essential. And that is one that all the people at the top, Nancy Pelosi, and all these people need to get on that frame.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is an occupation, and again, all the
and not a war. Yep.
Exactly.
Rebecca, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. Gary in Pittsburgh. Hey, Gary, have about
right.
a half a minute left here before
I
we have to wrap
right.
the show.
I knew I was going to be next. I wonder why. Let's get to the bottom line here. We need a serious.
I'm actually taking callers in the order they came in today.
I know. We need a serious candidate to solve serious problems. That's the bottom line. And I'm glad. And I may take just a hair, just a millisecond. Credit for thinking that Al Gore, last year when I called, as you recall, Al Gore, isn't the cream is coming to the top.
Yeah. No, I agree. And Al Gore is the best president of the United States who was never president of the United States. I mean,
you see how, yes, and we can't be strong at home, we can't be strong abroad if we're weak at home. That's what you're saying in so many words.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. Gary, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Coming up next, Brad Friedman, founder of BradBlog, is going to join us with the latest on the Busby election and voting problems all across the United States. Isn't this incredible? These toll roads, leasing toll roads, building a NAFTA highway. I mean, it's just. And by the way, Congress just gave itself the seventh straight pay raise, $3,300 a year. Nice work if you can get it. 57 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick note for our listeners in the Seattle area and the Washington State. George W. Bush apparently coming to town tomorrow, Friday, June 16th, if my information is correct. And there's a call for folks to participate in a die-in around that. You can go to olyblog.net, O-L-Y-B-L-O-G.net. And over on the left-hand side where it says upcoming events, the third one down says Bush in Seattle, June 16. Click on that, and it will bring up the page of, you know, Bush in Seattle. Call to action. Bush is coming to Bellevue, Washington. The puppet of the war machine in person in Cascadia. He is attending a fundraiser for old Rubber Bullet Reichert. Reichert, yeah. And so, anyhow, you can get the whole story. Just go over to OLY blog, Oly blog. I'm assuming I'm pronouncing it right, .net, OLYBLOG.net, if you're in the if you're in Washington State. Just a heads up. Brad, speaking of blogs, Brad Friedman is with us. He's the editor and founder of BradBlog, BradBlog.com. Hey, Brad, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you? Hey, with Bush coming to town, what time is your exclusive interview with him tomorrow?
You know, I go out of my way not to interview politicians, Brad, because what I've found is that if you ask them the hard questions, most politicians, let's say, if you ask them the hard questions, they essentially put you on a list that they'll never answer your questions, they'll never come on your program, and they tell all their friends and et cetera, and plus you don't get a decent answer anyway, number
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I usually find I get one interview with such people, and
yeah,
that's it.
And that's it. And or, number two, if you don't ask them the hard questions, then, you know, why bother, number one? And number two, I get all kinds of hate mail from my listeners about, why didn't you ask him this? Why didn't you ask him that? Why didn't you ask him that? But that doesn't bother me so much as the fact that it's a con game. It's, you know, I'm just not going to be one of those talk show hosts who basically spends most of his time sucking up to politicians.
Well, that's good, because so, I have a feeling Mr. Bush probably wouldn't want to come in the studio with you anyway for some
reason. No, he wouldn't. Yeah. And he would, I'm sure he would not like the questions I'd ask. Anyhow, we're talking with Brad Friedman. He's the editor and founder of BradBlog.com. And one of the blogs that, probably one of the very best blogs in the country, really looking at, listening to, getting a good handle on the issue of the theft of our elections here in the United States. And a number of questions for you, Brad. First of all, Busby, this whole Busby thing, her opponent was just sworn in?
That's correct. The opponent was sworn in before the votes, while they were still counting the votes, and before the election was actually certified by the state of California.
It still has not yet been certified, has it?
What's that?
It still has not been certified.
It won't be certified until, I think, June 28th at the earliest. And yet the Republicans felt it was okay to go ahead and swear him in, and he had his first speech on the floor of the House just a few days ago.
But he's actually not legally sworn in, is he?
He is actually sworn in. I've learned that what they did was they staged a mock swearing-in ceremony for the cameras, and then they had a private swearing-in ceremony, and then they let him speak on the floor of the House. So, yes, it actually now is official, and at least as far as the Congress is concerned. But back here in California, where the voters were trying to express their desires one way or another, they haven't even had their votes counted or the race certified. But I guess the folks in the Republicans in Congress don't give a damn.
Yeah, so this guy, his name is escaping me. Bill Wray?
Brian Bill Bray.
Bill, yeah. Bray, that's right. Okay.
What's most alarming here about this is that I've been reporting, as you know, over the past week, that these voting machines, they use all Diebold voting systems down there, optical scan and touchscreen. And what they did, we have now learned, in the days and weeks prior to the election was they sent these voting machines home with poll workers for days and weeks at a time. Now, it's been determined over the last few months that these Diebold machines in particular are hackable 7 ways to Sunday. I mean, there's dozens of ways that you can tamper with these machines in less than 2 minutes' time, no password necessary, and if you can get to one machine, it can affect the machines in the entire county. And so it's just a remarkable lapse of judgment by the registrar of voters out there to let the machines go out to poll workers, sit in their cars and garages for days and weeks at a time, unprotected, and in direct violation of both the federal standards and the California standards that were put in place a few months ago, when it was discovered how hackable these Diebold machines were.
Well, that's pretty outrageous in and of itself, but I have to say, Brad Friedman, in my mind, even more outrageous is the fact that we have privatized our elections. We have given our electoral process, the franchise by which democracy happens, the part of the commons, the most vital part of the commons, the part of the commons by which we administer the commons, we have privatized it. We have turned it over to private for-profit corporations, and they have no damn business telling us how we voted.
You're right, Tom, and you've been on this for a while. You've been right the entire time, and the fact of the matter is, because we have privatized it, these public officials don't know how these machines work. They don't know what the dangers are, and in the meantime, because of that, they actually bring in Diebold officials into the State House in Sacramento to write public documents about the machines that they're using in the election, that the Secretary of State is supposed to be, you know, guarding against and making sure that they're clear. We now have evidence that they're actually writing documents for the Secretary of State. It's an outrage, and, you know, I'm glad one upside here is that Lou Dobbs, who is no lefty moonbat,
The guy's a Republican.
Well, that's right. He has been reporting now, I think, 8 straight days on his show saying exactly that, that democracy is for sale. And the result is we've got these machines that are prone.
Of course, what has him flipped out is that one of the voting machine companies, Sequoia Systems, was bought by a couple of Venezuelans. And he's going, oh, no, Hugo Chavez can control our votes?
Right. But the good news is I think once he's been now looking at this, he's realizing that not only is Chavez can control our votes, but really any private.
Wally O'Dell could as well. Right. Now, so the Busbee vote. First of all, you said the votes are still being counted. Is there any possibility that the number of uncounted absentee and provisional ballots would be enough that if a significant percentage of them went for Busbee, that she actually is going to win the race?
Well, at this point, there's a few enough left that I don't think so. But that said, there is no reason to have confidence. And as a matter of fact, within the hour, I believe, PDA has posted a no-confidence declaration about the election. A Tribune columnist has done so. I've done so because the optical scanners, given that they have been that they're now contaminated, having been sent home, there is no reason to believe that they are accurate. Look, we just had 2 elections on the same day last week that we had the California elections up in Iowa, where 2 Republican incumbents lost their election. They were popular incumbents. They both lost the election after the ballots, the optical scan ballots, the paper ballots were scanned, which the election director up there was very responsible, unlike the one in San Diego, and she looked at it and said, something's wrong. Let's manually hand count these ballots. Guess what they found? They found that in both cases, the popular incumbent who had lost after the optical scan actually won when they counted the ballots. It reversed the election.
So it flipped the election.
We only
have a minute left here, Brad. One of the anomalies that you uncovered it over at bradblog.com that I found most fascinating was that the Libertarian candidate for office in every other district in the state of California where these primaries were held was pulling in, you know, 100 votes here, 100 votes there kind of thing. But in Francine Busbee's district, he did something quite different.
Yeah, it turns out because they had a primary race on the same, because this was a special election to fill Duke Cunningham's seat. So at the same time, they also had the primary for the November election. And there was very strange numbers concerning the Libertarians where they got some vote counts that really can't be explained. But again, it simply underscores the fact that what we need to do with those machines having been contaminated and, in fact, decertified because of those security breaches, we need to count those optically scanned ballots. And if I could, I want to point, folks, there is now a petition up at velvetrevolution.us that you can sign and that encourages the Francine Busby to come out and make a statement, and most importantly, the San Diego County Registrar, who I spoke with yesterday and interviewed. He has no clue about the security breaches, and it demands that they count these ballots. I don't care who wins, Tom. I just want to know that the announced winner is actually the one who received the most votes.
Right, and the fact of the matter is that we don't know that in the United States, and we haven't since Reagan began the process of privatizing our vote.
Well, and it's getting much worse by the day right now with these electronic voting machines, especially this year. And it's we're heading towards a train wreck, Tom.
Yeah, velvetrevolution.us.
Yes, sir.
The place for, and of course, for more information, you can go over to bradblog.com. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, the editor and founder. Brad, thanks for being with us today.
Always great to talk to you, Tom.
Ditto. Good talking with you, too. 17 minutes past the hour. Again, folks in Seattle, go over to olyblog.net, O-L-Y-B-L-O-G.net, and click on the link about Bush coming to Seattle in June 2006 under the upcoming events. Check that out. 17 minutes past the hour. Taking our country back with Steve Sinton right after this.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hart.
I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her. Been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you lost Iraq. So I'm taking my car.
Oh, we're taking our country back, my friends.
We had a fondo and the treasury drawer. More than there had ever been before. But every day we're drowning deeper in debt. Maybe 4 years should be all you get. Then you gave tax breaks to the millionaires. And you tried to make the working man pay. But you can't tax a man when his job's not there. Now look at where we are today. Hey, I'm taking my car.
It's our Taking My Country Back segment for the week. Back some months ago, Congressman Bernie Sanders said to us in his regular weekly program with us, you know, instead of supporting parties and groups and whatnot, you ought to find some good candidates. You ought to feature them on your radio program, good progressive candidates. Point people to their websites, send them over there, give them 25, 50, 100 bucks, whatever they can afford. Get them active all over the country. And we've been doing it ever since in our Taking My Country Back segment. Today we're featuring Steve Sinton. He's running for the U.S. Congress in Georgia's 6th District, where I used to live back in, this is Newt Gingrich's old district. Steve Sinton on the line. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Tom. We're hoping you'll move back so you can vote for me.
You know, I look back on it. I wish I'd never sold the house down there. Boy, property values have exploded. Steve Sinton, by the way, the website, stevesinton.com. Check it out. Steve, let's just, this is Sandy Strings, Alpharetta, Canton, Woodstock, Dunwoody, Marietta, Newt's, as I said, Newt's old district. Immigration. Give us your take on immigration.
Well, that's right. We're here in the North Atlanta burbs, which are the fifth wealthiest congressional district in the country, very highly educated one, and one that our Pew Research shows that has a huge chasm between religious Republicans and economic ones, and that the religious Republicans will always come out, Hezbollah always comes out and always vote for the right side, but the economic ones have had enough, and they will fire somebody in November if they demonstrate incompetence. You lived here long enough to know that Georgians fire losing football coaches anyway.
Sure.
You asked me about immigration, and I'm up against a guy who wants to build a fence around the country to keep people out, and I want to build a fence around the country to keep jobs in. At this juncture, we've been given two options, and both of them are really lousy options. The first is deport everybody, and do you know how much it costs to do that?
It's insane. I mean, it's
$41 billion.
Yeah, plus you've got to identify them. Plus you've got to identify. It's crazy.
You're right. ICE, the immigration customs guys, call those notices to disappear when they send those out.
Right.
So that's never going to happen. And you can't give everybody amnesty because we don't have the means or the infrastructure to do this.
Right.
This all happened because this administration and this Congress left the porch light on. They wanted cheap labor. I don't know.
Ever since 86. I mean, we don't have an illegal immigration problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States.
Precisely. You know, why is it that every solution the Republicans come up with is to enrich their donor base?
Well, they want to build a fence so that they can. It really should be called the Halliburton Full Employment Act.
You got it, man.
You know, because that's who's going to build the fence.
Yeah, so they have come up with 11 million illegals in the
country. So your immigration solution is to start busting the employers.
Yes, absolutely.
Good on you. I'm right there with you. Schools that we just have a couple minutes here, Steve. Schools that teach. I've got your topic list here. I just want to give you a chance to put out some of your talking points. We're talking with Steve Sinton. His website, stevesinton.com. Schools.
Yeah, well, they would be schools that prepare our children for success, not teach to a test. I mean, here in Georgia, we've been through No Child Left Behind, and they prepped all these kids for the test, and they passed that McGraw-Hill test beautifully, and we're 49th in SATs, and my gosh, we're 49th in everything else, Tom. The license plates ought to say, thank God for Mississippi.
Okay, family security, Steve.
People want to be safe in their homes, they want to be safe in their jobs, in their retirement, and they want their kids to be safe at school. And government has to guarantee that to the community.
Steve Sinton, stevesinton.com. Go check it out. Check out his website. Help him out. This guy is running for Congress. He has a good shot at getting in. This is a real candidate, a real race, and a real Democrat. Finally, somebody I agree with on immigration, too, Democrat.
Tom,
yeah.
Tom,
yes,
vote,
Steve.
Vote for me on the DFA endorsement list.
Great. Yeah, okay. You can do that, too. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Do you believe, or you were wanted to see? I'm just trying to find peace while you held up the freeze. Coming through, epidemic, can you cure this disease? You are live on the line, yeah, you know what I mean. Human being, created the gun, aimed at the funds for war. Assembling troops, hiding the truth, we mourn. Never too late to find yourself reborn. Connecting overseas, the sun, where it's born.
So there you have it, my whole life.
Okay, welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. If you want to vote for Steve Sinton at the Democracy for America site, go to, don't put it in www, put tools.democracyforamerica, democracyforamerica.com/housevote. Tools, tools.democracyforamerica.com/housevote. And you can vote for Steve Sinton there because Democracy for America is figuring out who they're gonna support. Here's a guy who gets it. He's a real progressive, and he's in Georgia, and he has an actual chance to take back Newt Gingrich's district, a district I used to live in. I can tell you, there's a lot of Democrats in that district, a lot of good people in that district. So go check it out. tools.democracyforamerica.com/housevote, and you know, give him a plug. It'll be a good thing. Be a fine thing, in fact. Be an important thing, in fact. I mean, this is all about getting out there and getting active and making things happen. Now, to a quick look at what's going on. Sadly, a quick look at what's going on in Iraq.
I want to know what the man in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon. And there are blood on the wire.
In the occupation of Iraq, in Bakaba, gunmen shot dead at least 10 laborers as they were heading to work in that city. Also, Dateline Bakaba, a woman and her son were severely injured when a bomb exploded in a graveyard in the town of Korotava, north of Bakaba. Police defused two other bombs planted in the same cemetery. In Tal Afar, three roadside bombs targeting Iraqi army patrols killed 5 soldiers and injured another 6 in the town of Tal Afar. In Tikrit, 4 worshippers were killed and 20 others were injured when gunmen attacked a mosque. In Kirkuk, gunmen shot dead an Iraqi soldier in the city of Hawija. In Bakaba, gunmen shot dead police Colonel Shakir Mahmoud, director of units protecting oil installations in Bakaba. In Baghdad, security forces have seized Al-Qaeda in Iraq documents giving key information about the militant group's network and the whereabouts of its leaders. You can bet that that's going to be something the Bush administration is going to be talking about a lot. And in Baghdad, the U.S. military says it believes the real name of Al-Qaeda in Iraq's new leader is Egyptian Abu Ayyab al-Masri, and that he will replicate the bloody tactics of his slain predecessor. George Bush has a new Lex Luthor. He has got to be so pleased. As of this moment, the United States deaths, the latest figures for military deaths in Iraq, all of this from Reuters, by the way, 2,500 for the United States, 113 for Britain, 112 for other nations. Military Iraqi deaths between 4,800 and 6,300. Civilian deaths between 38,000 and 42,747. These are the most conservative numbers available. Insurgents are also attacking the Iraq oil sector. This is also from Reuters. Iraq's oil sector, hobbled by decades of war, sanctions, and underinvestment, may derive little benefit from the death on Thursday of Iraq's al-Qaeda leader. Al-Zarqawi analysts said relentless sabotage has so devastated the infrastructure in the north of the country that oil exports from Iraq's giant Kirkuk field have only been a rare possibility. And on it goes. So, our report from the occupation, not the war. The war was over in 2003, from the occupation of Iraq. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Tom, that highway you're talking about, is that going to be part of that North American Union that Bush and Fox and Martin are going to create?
Yeah, this came out of the meeting that they had in March of 2005.
Okay, well then, if that highway goes through, it's probably going to come under eminent domain. But didn't the Supreme Court let the door open for the states to block any?
No. No. Actually, it's the other way around. The states can take property and give it to private corporations. And, in fact, the highway that they're building across Texas, they're negotiating right now with a company out of Spain to build this thing and make it a toll road.
One other thing. Tom, in the Iran-Contra hearing, did Ali North ever mention Osama bin Laden's name?
I don't have any idea.
Oh, okay.
At that point in time, I was not paying that much attention to Osama bin Laden, so I don't recall. That's the sort of thing that you can track it down probably with a good Google search, Jim. If you find out, let me know, would you?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Life in Hoodsport, Washington. Is it Life or Leaf?
Life.
Leif.
Leif. Leif. Yes.
Yeah. How you doing? What's up?
I'm doing just fine. I just have a question that relates to the so-called war on terror that is without end. And that is, do you foresee the possibility of reinstating the draft at some time?
I hope so.
And why would you answer that way?
Because if we had a draft right now, we would not have a war in Iraq. If the children of every economic class in the United States were participating in our military, they would not be cannon fodder. The people who have considerable political influence and who donate to political campaigns would not tolerate it.
Okay.
I think that we should do what most industrialized countries do. I lived a year in Germany and saw this up close and personal. Several good friends of mine, they had kids who hit military age when we lived in Germany. When you graduate from high school in Germany, you have to do a year of community service. You can do it in one of two ways. You can either volunteer for a nonprofit, like work in a hospital, something like that, or you can go into the army. But you have to do one or the other. And it's a great rite of passage, and we've lost our rites of passage in the United States. So instead, kids join gangs, or they go out and do drugs, or they see how drunk they can get at the prom night or whatever. It's a great rite of passage. It gives kids, those who want to go overseas, a chance to see the world. Those who want to do some community service, it puts them in touch with the needs of people who are outside of their community, outside of their social sphere. Usually they move them to other cities to do their community service, so it gives them a sense of the larger world. And those who go through the military have the experience of the military. They have a very diverse military. Every country where there has been a military coup, a military uprising, where the military goes out of control, has, virtually without exception, you look back through the history of the world, has been an army that is basically a mercenary army, a paid army, as opposed to a draftee army. Draftee armies do not rise up against the countries that they represent. And that's why I think that our army, like Germany's, like Israel's, like pretty much every other industrialized country, should be a draftee army.
Well, thanks so much for your answer.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And it's a position, by the way, that Thomas Jefferson took. He said, I hope we never see the day when our young men will be willing to be shot at, will be so poor that they are willing to be shot at for a sixpence. And that's what we have right now, and I think it's a terrible thing. It's an absolutely terrible thing. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, what's up?
Hi, I'm calling about the privatization of the highways, and I think it's probably from our trade agreements that they can do things like that, correct?
Yes. Well, in part, actually. I mean, you know, the privatization of our highways doesn't depend on our trade agreements, but the ability of a container from China to show up in a port in Mexico and make its way from Mexico to anywhere in the United States basically without being checked, with the Mexican truck drivers driving in the United States, no longshoremen, no Teamsters, no U.S. Union presence at all. That's in large part a response because of NAFTA.
Right. Well, I think they're so related, and it's a big old steamroller on anybody who's not privileged.
Yep.
But my question is, I have two, does the average Democratic Congress member even have a grasp of how our trade agreements have become the big de facto government overseeing our seemingly pretend constitutionally limited government? And has Al Gore ever related the juggernaut power of the oligarchy who do the polluting and have obscene amounts of capital that enable them to buy more lying scientists who refute the reality of global warming and who buy more NAFTA-like legislation? Does he relate that to the tie-breaking vote that he cast to pass NAFTA back in 1994?
You know, with regard to Al Gore and NAFTA and his casting that vote, and you're right, he did. And that was the policy of the Clinton administration. Bill Clinton made NAFTA happen. He had to twist a lot of arms and cut a lot of deals in order to make NAFTA happen. And, whether Al Gore regrets that vote or not, I don't know. I have never heard him speak about it. I would be amazed if he didn't. But you know, I just don't know. I've heard Bill Clinton has come out and said he wished that he hadn't pushed it like he did.
Well, I want Al Gore to admit that those anti-American protectionist trade policies, because they protect the oligarchy, they have concentrated power to the corporations who govern our government.
Yes, I would like to hear him talk about that too. And I don't know that he's not talking about it. He may well be. I mean, my tracking Al Gore's political discourses over the last couple of years has not been exactly where it should be. But I know that he's been speaking truth to power in some real significant ways lately. So it wouldn't surprise me at all.
And I'm on board with him that global warming is a moral issue. It's just subordinate to this larger looming problem that we have. But are there any other Congress members that have a grasp about how these trade agreements are?
There are, Bernie Sanders, Peter DeFazio, and some of the conservative, Ron Paul down in Texas. I mean, you've got some honest conservatives and some honest liberals who really get it. And then you got a bunch of people who are in the pockets of the big corporations because our political system is so badly broken, Bonnie. And you just have to go member by member. And I've not done a census, so I don't frankly know, how many. I don't know if the average one gets it or not, but certainly a lot of them do. Bonnie, got to run
thank
along.
You.
But thank you. Thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to us there on WPTT. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
People speak of love, don't know what they're thinking of. Wait around for the one who fits just like a glove. Speak in terms of belief and belonging.
38.2 million people. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. 38.2 million people, according to the Wall Street Journal, which is citing the U.S. Department of Agriculture, experienced food insecurity. 13.9 million children. 13.5 million households. 11.9% of U.S. households, that's more than one out of every 10 households in the United States, quote, were uncertain they could afford to feed their families at some point during the year 2004, the last year for which statistics are available. About a third of these said about at least one household member went hungry at least sometime during the year because the family couldn't afford enough food. This in the United States of America. Congress, by the way, just gave themselves a little more than a $3,000 a year pay raise. One of the teachers in one of the schools where they serve school lunches says, on this from the Wall Street Journal article, on Friday at lunch, I see a kind of panic in some children that I didn't see before. They eat as much as they can, says Kim Matthews, youth service coordinator at the Chapel Hill, Texas school district. And then on Monday at breakfast, they not only eat the food on their tray, but the food on the trays of the five kids next to them. There's a whole article about what they call backpackers, kids who are smuggling food out of school because it's the only source of food in their lives, because their family doesn't have enough money to buy food. Texas, by the way, the highest percentage of households that have difficulty feeding their families, 16.4%. 16.4%. What is that? That's about one in seven? More or less? One in seven families in Texas is experiencing hunger in the United States of America. What have we come to? And poverty is increasing in the United States. And you get these cons on and they say, well, you know, Bill Clinton ended welfare as we know it. Thanks a lot, Bill. Well, you know, poverty, hunger did go down. Well, yeah, the economy went up. But now that the economy is going back down, poverty and hunger are going back up again. And there's no infrastructure to deal with it. There's no programs to deal with it. And how are we to be judged as a nation and as a people? Frankly, in my opinion, by how we treat the least among us. Here we have literally hungry children, 13.9 million hungry children. We're not talking, you know, hey, they're not eating the very best food. We're talking real, actual hunger in the United States. And these are not, by the way, the people in the shadows, like the Republicans like to refer to. This is not illegal immigration populations. This cuts right across all racial lines, the geographic lines. This is just plain old-fashioned poverty, the result of our jobs being shipped overseas because of these insane trade policies, and the jobs that are left, the labor force being diluted to the point where my brother made a living as a roofer for years and years. He had a good union job as a roofer, as a carpenter. Put two of his kids through college as a roofer. He can't get a job as a roofer any longer. They're just not there. Not a union job anyway. Not a job that he could support his family with. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Hey, talk about a euphemism. Food insecurity. Why not just call it what it is? Hunger, man.
Yeah. You know. Well, it's because they're not hungry all year long. They're hungry, you know, at least a couple times during the year.
Yeah, you're not going to hear FDR, right? One-third of a nation ill-clad, ill-housed, ill-fed, right? Not from this clown.
No, you're not.
Yeah.
And this is now it's, this is about one-tenth of the nation.
Right, right.
I mean, 13.5 million households, and there's what, about 115 million households in the United States?
Exactly. I wanted to expand a little on your framing of language and saying using the word occupation rather than the word war, which I agree with. But now, you know, Rove and Bush are conflating again the 9/11 in Iraq to imply that Murtha and Cleland are wussies, right?
Right.
So every time the topic of Iraq comes up, only Howard Dean and Cindy Sheehan do this. Every time it comes up, the first thing out of their mouth is to distinguish Afghanistan. They say, we liberals supported the overthrow of the Taliban criminals because that was the true link to 9/11. Now let's talk about the other unrelated war called Iraq.
Right.
They always do that, and I don't know why more liberals off the bat always say, Afghanistan we supported, true link, just like France is still in Afghanistan. Germany had troops die in Afghanistan because they know that's the true link. Now let's talk about the unrelated Iraqi criminal thing.
Yeah. Well,
and
good,
you know,
good
yeah.
point, Tom. Good point. Tom, I got to move along. Thank
yeah.
you. Good point. Dixie in Seattle. Hey, Dixie, we're just about out of time. What's on your mind?
Well, you could say that when that thing with Dino Rossi and Christine Gregoire up here, he was prematurely sworn in. And they even are congratulating him back in Washington, D.C., and I think he made a trip back there.
Oh, really? He did the same thing that Busby's opponent
yeah.
did?
They jumped the gun. They thought they had it all sewed up. Definitely.
These Republicans, they know their tricks.
Yeah.
Dixie, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks
okay,
for listening
bye.
There on Talk 1090.
Yeah, bye.
It's 56 minutes past the hour. Well, it's the end of the show. We'll be back tomorrow. Coming up on tomorrow's program, of course, Bernie Sanders' Brunch with Bernie in the first hour. Cal Dooley, the president of the Grocery Manufacturers Association, he's going to tell us why big government conservatives want to take away the power of the states to control their own food supply, and he thinks this is a good thing. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group of, by, and for, we the people of the United States. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See ya.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.